Welcome to another episode of We Are Carbon. I'm Helen Fisher and I'm joined by Daniel Denoid Powell, horticulturalist and garden designer from the UK, who now lives with his wife and young family in France on their 1.5 acre homestead. As I record this intro in the UK, spring is weaving its magic all around us. And as the days get longer and brighter, I simply can't resist being outside and getting my hands in the soil just as much as I possibly can. Gardening is so many things to so many people. From therapy in nature to food production, a space to entertain, spend time with family, and even a way to get a good workout and save on the gym. Our own little spots in the outdoors can be really valuable to our well-being. And within our vision for a regenerative future that we're building here through We Are Carbon, I thought it would be a mistake to ignore the role that gardens might play in impacting the health of the entire planet too. Woven into our everyday actions, scaled up by the vast numbers of them, gardens are the most direct opportunity that many of us have for getting connected with soil. And gardens could be community spaces too, or a growing area at a school, a green space adjacent to towering office blocks. With recognition of the value that even the smallest patch of ground can offer, you'll start to see potential everywhere. Which is why I'm so delighted to have had the opportunity to speak with Daniel. His passion and connection to nature is clear, and he has a wide range of experience producing food, designing gardens and food forests, and running unique enterprises such as an edible flower farm to make small-scale growing profitable. We touch on all of this alongside gleaning some very practical guidance for anyone considering creating an edible biodiversity garden. To learn more from Daniel and to keep exploring our journey here at We Are Carbon, be sure to check the links in the description. I'll let Daniel introduce himself now. I hope you enjoy.
My name is Daniel Powell, Daniel Powell, that's my wife's name. We moved to France in 2012. We set up a permaculture garden, 6,500 square meters. So it's not that big, but there was an existing garden. So we've got big oaks and walnut trees, etc. We quickly fell upon a niche in the market. So we started creating edible flowers for chefs. Then we were asked to design gardens and manage them. So I do some normal gardening on one side, and then we started creating edible gardens, permaculture gardens, like no-dig vegetable gardens at the restaurants. And we did that for almost 10 years, which was good. And now we are moving into, we had a brief period where we did cut flowers during COVID. Because the restaurants were closed, but the florists were open, and a lot of edible flowers are also cut flowers. So we're like, well, just change the labeling, so to speak, and sell them to florists. And then recently we've moved from edible flowers to cut flowers to now wild flowers. So I was always in the background, and now I've kind of stepped to the forefront, and now we're working with anyone and everyone, really. From small individually owned gardens to golf courses, farms, and like manors, I guess you'd say, big domains. And we do more creation of wildflower meadows and managing woodlands and things like that. We're kind of doing biodiversity gardens now with a little bit of edible gardening there as well.
Thank you. It's really exciting actually to talk about gardening, because in the scope of looking after people and looking after the planet, there's all these big grand visions that we can hear about, very sort of industrial scale considerations, and then we've got farming. But the sort of humble garden, it often gets overlooked, and yet because there's so many of us, we have our own little sites that we can work on. There's a huge potential here to offer a really big impact to the world through our little gardening practices and operations, and obviously that connects in then to bigger projects too. So it's really great to be able to take a sort of look at this and consider gardening as a rounded solution that people can get very hands-on with. When you say an edible biodiversity garden, how does that differ to what people might think of from a standard garden, maybe a lawn and some flower beds?
Right, yeah. Well, taking a garden, quite often we come across gardens in a very raw state, like you say, just lawns, formal gardens are my enemy. So I normally arrive when we have a formal garden or no garden at all. And yeah, it is just classic garden shed right at the end. Vegetable garden right at the end on the other side, because they're apparently ugly. And then you have a lawn in the middle, and there's a couple of borders either side, and maybe a wiggly line just to give it some sort of feel that is natural. But and then a lot of money spent just around the house on some paving slabs and a little retaining wall and some steps. That we get confronted by quite often. So taking that is kind of like that's great, but already there's been a lost opportunity, because gardens are expensive. You know, there's a lot of material to be handled. It's very physical, I guess, as well. And if you want to make big changes, big sweeping changes, well, that costs a lot. You can spend a lot of money on a garden. I mean, I don't know what the average amount spent on a garden is in the UK in terms of design and everything, but you can spend a lot. And I think the thing with biodiversity gardens and edible gardens is that, a bit like us here, we started with nothing, like absolutely nothing. And everything was just done with your own hands and a couple of hand tools. So in terms of a pastime, it's pretty good. You don't need a lot, and yet you could spend your entire life gardening, which is fantastic. And once you get the healthy kind of cycles of life into your garden, it gives you what you need. So you can collect the seeds, and you can find trees and bushes and holly and all sorts. So you can kind of fill the garden up with itself, just moving pieces around like Lego, if you take your time, and if you follow the kind of like natural cycles, which do take time. Biodiversity gardens, I mean, an edible garden can be many things, like a permaculture garden could be many things. We started out creating a permaculture garden, but for me, it was always like it was an underpinning philosophy, but I wanted to know more into each aspect of the edible side of it, into the biodiversity side of it. And that's why I like to say edible biodiversity garden, because it's paying homage to the people that have already been there and done it, I guess. The idea of them just coming with a new all-encompassing word when people have been growing food for a long time, and biodiversity has existed even longer than that. So I like to say that, and I basically like to give my designs, I like to try and aim for a third edible for us, which can be biodiverse. It can be beautiful. You can have auxiliary plants, you can have trees, fruit trees. You know, we need all those systems, but I don't want to cut it off and say, like, if it's not an auxiliary plant because it doesn't bring in bees and pollinators, then I'm not going to plant it. That doesn't really make sense. I mean, normally, if it's not an auxiliary plant, it's just because we don't know how it functions in the bigger circle. So, you know, everything overlaps quite a lot. And so my edible gardens overlap with my biodiversity gardens in terms of like the zones within them and how they function. And you can't really have a good edible garden if you don't have a biodiversity garden, because it's the underpinning framework and structure of the garden. You know, you need those cycles, and within it you have this. We'll probably touch upon it a bit later, but you can't have all the good without the bad, and it's not bad; it's just death and decay. But that sets up the next year, so it's about creating full cycles.
So in that sense, it's very functional, and the biodiversity is assisting with these cycles and supporting the production in the garden. Would you consider to really maximise the benefits of what we can do in our spaces that there could be some incorporation of the thoughts that guide organic and regenerative farming, for example?
Yeah, so there's some fantastic individuals out there that give a lot of time and a lot of content on regenerative farming. And I kind of have like the godfathers and the godmothers because there's a few in there as well, of what I do. For me, like, hands down, it's Charles Darling, because he is like the reference. And even all the no-till guys in America will eventually get back to Charles Darling in the UK. I'm going to name drop just throughout this podcast, because they're important and they give a lot of free content. So it's important that people go there and pick up this advice, because they're people that have done it and done it for a long time. And they work in such a way that it's never about short-term goals with them. Again, it's going back to these cycles. So they put as much effort as they do into the soil as they do into their plants, if not more. And they put as much effort into preparing for the next year as they do working in the current year, you know? So these guys are like passionate, but also absolutely obsessive about the quality of their soil and the quality of their compost and how quickly they can turn around compost. Like, I'm pretty sure it's Richard Perkins at Ridgedale Farm. He did compost in like 16 days or something. I mean, he has a lot of trainees that go there, but I mean, they're constantly turning it and they're getting all the levels right and they're checking the humidity and they've got the resources to do it. But still, like that level of passion about something which is kind of like the back end, the side of gardening that we don't like talking about. But for them, it's so important because they know that next year and the year after and the year after, and indeed in terms of the generations that come, it will just get easier and easier and easier as the soils get better and better and better. Without wanting to go into like the microbiology, because I don't really understand, that's not my job, but in terms of like healthy plants and healthy human beings, microbial activity in the gut and things like this, it's all interlinked. You can learn a lot from those people. I incorporate it into my gardens because I haven't found a better example, a more productive way of producing food for yourself, for your family on a small scale as you get in. So in science it's called it's called living soil agriculture, maraîchage sol vivant. And it would be no-till in the US and it would be no-digging in the UK. And it's just, it turns gardening, it turns a laborious task into a real pleasure. And if they can make it work on not particularly large areas of land, and I apply the same principles and just scale it down as opposed to scaling it up, then I can make really small, really functional gardens. But again, I can only do that if I have a lot of organic matter. They bring it in truckloads, whereas I like to get rid of all the supply chains and plant a biodiversity garden to give me the organic matter to allow me to create edible gardens that are no-dig.
So if we delve into this a little bit deeper in terms of the systems of life that are supporting what you describe as sort of, it sort of makes it easier every year, that there's the sort of more structure in the soil, there's more there to support more and more and more year on year. That's kind of coming down to this ecosystem. And if we were sort of to define the key areas, the elements of the garden that people should be looking to incorporate, so those elements of nature that are working with them as part of their team, what would you outline them as? What would you include within that? So, if, for example, if pollinators was one element, how would you round that out to everything?
There's absolutely no substitute for organic matter, right? It doesn't, whether it's partly broken down, decomposed. So for example, I didn't have enough time to finish off my compost. So I sent a tweet, as it was, to Charles Darling and said, do you mind? Can I put unused, unfinished compost in my paths? And he was like, yeah, go for it. Just let it carry on breaking down in the path. So like, but I always refer back to Lego because I got two young sons. Your Lego building blocks, if you will, it's organic matter, and you can't have that on a young garden. What we're looking for is that leaf litter. And so I like to start off by really checking out the structure of the garden and incorporating as many trees, but not open grown trees. So all of the hazelnuts and all of the coppice trees, because they're the ones that will grow quickly. They're nice and dense, so they're good for biodiversity. They're good for bees. That tight branch structure means you get a lot of moths and butterflies laying the larvae in between the branches, I believe they do. And so you can really mix up those in and around. You'll create windbreaks, you'll protect your structures, you'll protect your vegetable gardens, your fruit bushes, etc. But doing that alone means you're getting in place the bigger, longer cycles. So if every 5, 6, 7 years you coppice all of your hazelnuts, or a third of your hazelnuts, as you're meant to do, you've got a lot of mulch, you've got a lot of leaf litter, you've got a lot of protection, you've got a lot of moisture retention when it gets hot. You're bringing in activity in many different forms, and so you're straight away starting to accumulate that level of humus on the ground. And if you want to, 1 year you can just put it all over the place, spread it around. Some years I don't chip up my branches, for example. I'll just put them back into the hedge to build up that density in the undergrowth for the hedgehogs and things like that. And then the next year I might decide, like, well, the vegetable garden needs a bit of a boost. So all of that will go into the chipper, and I put it straight into my compost, which gives the compost a much more structured consistency. You get a lot of mushrooms and fungal activity in the vegetable garden. So, I mean, once you have a surplus of organic matter, for us it took, I'd say, 7 or 8 years. So it does take time. I think you need to get those into place straight away. Afterwards, a really good pond, which I still don't have after 10 years because they're quite expensive, and I didn't want to make a mistake, so I wanted to get it right. So I still haven't done it. And I watch and I read so much about them. But yeah, a water course is pretty essential for nature, for biodiversity, for bees. What else would we include there? There's a lot. The main thing is that, like, don't keep it tidy. Nature doesn't like tidy. It wants to. There's so many different aspects of a garden that are healthier when they aren't tidy. If you constantly tidy up around yourself. The classic is, if you go into a garden that is a bit derelict, no one's been in there for a while, and you find an old corrugated metal sheet, it's waste. It's a bit ugly, it's rusty, it's pretty dangerous. The second you move it, you'll probably find some field mice and some snakes and all sorts underneath it. But it's a little refugium, as they say. And it's remarkable, and yet it's just a piece of waste that's on the ground. Well, that's what nature wants. And so you can do that, but do it in a way that's kind of more organic materials. So the piles of branches, for example. And even, like, I read the other day how rather than build a hibernaculum, I love this word, hibernaculum for animals to overwinter. Well, actually, if you take that and you put it on a high point that always stays dry, you'll get a completely different grouping of animals in it. And if you put it on, like, a bit that stays a bit damper, that will change again. And if you actually put it in a small basin, like a hollow, which will naturally pool up with water, then you're quite likely to get salamanders and things like that. So we're taking the same idea and we're just moving it around the garden, and you've created a little micro ecosystem every time, wherever it goes. There's really simple little things like that, and it's just experimentation, isn't it? Like, just be a bit of a child about it, have fun with it.
It's very exciting to me to incorporate all of these things into a space, because I've always loved to see insects. And because I've kind of found insects so intriguing, like as a child, fascinated by them, it has made me very, very aware of people's poor relationship with them in general. Like, I think that it's wonderful. We know that biodiversity is wonderful, but people do like clean spaces, and they like have this, it's like a familiarity with a very sterile garden. There's pretty flowers, but it's all clean and tidy, and all the organic waste has gone in the plastic bin to be taken away. And there's a sense that we have a bad relationship with insects. And I wonder if that is something that you see a barrier to people creating a biodiversity garden.
So, yeah, that's something I get confronted by a lot. Changing those paradigms and those ways of thinking. I mean, they are there fundamentally to, I think it's embedded in the culture, and in every, I've noticed it in France, actually, because in France, wolves, for some reason, kids love wolves. All the books are about wolves. I know we have them in England a little bit, but in France, like, a child is called a little wolf all the time, and it's kind of cute. And yet, it's not really an animal that kind of, like, you see that much. If you hear about it on the news, you're a bit like, oh, like, there's wolves around? That's a bit weird, even though they're being reintroduced, and even though they're really essential. And it's a good example, because you need these you need these animals, like, you need these animals to maintain the trophic levels. I mean, and this is something that gets lost. So through our deep-seated psychological fears of spiders, because one person gets bitten and therefore linear thinking, all spiders must be bad. And I could say the same for hornets, because I've been stung quite a few times by hornets and they are really painful. But we forget what role they serve. So, like, no one likes to have a cloud of flies on their food when they're eating dinner. And yet we don't want spiders in the same room. Well, spiders eat flies, so why would you not like spiders? And we can go over and over and over again. And, like, you'll always find a reason, like, I think it's cockroaches. I can remember someone talking about how cockroaches are essential if you want to have, like, a healthy house. But we absolutely hate cockroaches because they're a bit chunky and they're creepy crawlies. But they do a really good job. And so there's a lot of education. I don't think I've ever confronted a job where the client's been kind of, there's always something, there's always a little hang up somewhere. And so in the French countryside, it's generally snakes. Snakes is a big thing in France. We absolutely hate snakes. And whenever I mention snake, the client takes like a half step back, as if to say, like, whoa, we're not going to create environments that are going to encourage snakes, are we? And I'm like, well, if you want a long grass wildflower meadow, yeah, we are. It's exactly what we're going to do. But at the same time, so for example, when you maintain a wildflower meadow, at the end of the year, we're going to cut, scythe down all the grass, try not to leave as little waste as possible. We're going to take all that waste and we're going to create a big pile somewhere, so that way it becomes a habitat. And I say to the client, well, don't worry, because all the snakes are going to be in that pile of grass there. So just don't walk around it. Don't go near it. Don't stamp on it, jump on it or anything. You can be sure that there will be snakes in there, but at least they won't be in your garden. So, you know, you can relax. In my own experience, nature is terrified of human beings. Nature absolutely is terrified of human beings. Even on the radio the other day, there's a study about in Africa, if you play the sound of a human's voice, animals don't stop running. They won't even stop to defend themselves. So the worst noise you could possibly play in the savannah is the sound of a human being just talking. They're more scared of the human voice than a gun or a chainsaw, which is just remarkable. When I have problems with nature, it's because I've interfered in their domain. And normally that only happens if you're working too fast and you're not paying due respect. You're not looking out. So every time I've been bitten by a hornet, it's because I was strimming and the hornets were in the ground before they went up into the trees. And I essentially just smashed into their home with the blade of a strimmer. Well, of course they're going to be annoyed. They don't want to actively do you any harm. So if you just slow down a little bit and you observe what's going on around you, I would have seen that hornet's nest. But of course I wasn't. I was there to do a job and I did it. And the same with wasps. So the only time I've been stung by wasps was because they were in the polytunnel, but they were right next to the entrance. This is back when we were doing edible flowers. So we had to move them while they stung me. So again, it's me encroaching on their domain. Everything has a purpose, everything has a value, and nature really does not want to get into a scuffle with you. So you just need to slow down a little bit and be a bit respectful that you are kind of, yeah.
Have you ever come into a situation where you felt it's necessary to control what's there? Or do you feel that the best advice is for people to observe and allow nature to kind of introduce new bits and pieces to find its own balance?
Horses for courses. Quite often, well, it's very, very aware that nature is working as it's intended. It's a constant flux, if you will. And we've taken out very, very important elements of that. So when a client says to me, like, I want to do some rewilding, for example, straight away, my ears will prick up, and I'm like, well, let's really dig down into what exactly you mean. Do you mean we're not going to do anything, and we're just going to observe it? In which case we can, but I can almost guarantee you what's going to happen, because we don't have the processes at a high level. There's a reason why we use so many machines, I think, in agriculture and in garden design and garden creation. We don't have beasts anymore, quite simply. We don't have the ruminants that will manage really, like, I think the largest grassland, prairie grassland, in the US is like 76 million hectares. Now, mankind is not capable of managing 76 million hectares in a way that nature can, if at all. So, you know, we don't have that. We haven't had that in Europe for a long time. And so the idea of rewilding, you know, rewilding works within the confines of the wilderness that is already on your land. So I'm pretty sure if you spoke to Isabella Tree of Napa State, she'd probably say, like, well, rewilding is fantastic, but we are dependent upon the nature that exists around. And so I like to think of it, I'm quite happy to create the platform in the theater for nature to have a play and figure out its own way. And we need to do that. And sometimes you have to do it as well, because you can't accelerate certain processes. I can't just take out a magic wand and just call for the beasts of the nature to just appear in the garden. But you can give them the conditions in which to thrive. And then you get that, as we spoke about before, that trophic cascade, I think it's called. I'm mixed French and English. I'm pretty sure it's called trophic cascade. And so you can do that. You create a spark, and then everything else comes. Like in Scotland with the new barrier reef that's made out of shells, I think it is. And they're putting oysters on there because oysters will filter the water. And also you get loads of other species that thrive in the same environment created by the oysters. So they start with that one spark. So I like to do that, and do that in as many different ecological niches to create the mosaic. And then once you get that complexity, that's when you start to get really, really rare things appearing.
It we're gaining this insight into a very woven environment, lots of different habitats and different experiences in there that are all part of the whole. And this might be a really difficult question, because these kind of questions often are, but if you was to take us through your dream garden, help us to understand what that would look like if we're walking through it.
Well, I'm working on it at the moment. I've been working on it for 10 years, but I don't have a stream or a coastline or a river or even an ancient forest. So I guess it would never actually be my dream garden. There are some, I think a dream garden for me is one that looks like it's always been there. I like to leave a site at the end of the day or at the end of a job, and it looks like it's always been there. You know, the stonework, ponds, whatever, they looks like you've never actually gone there to do any work. That's how my dream garden would be. So it could have been created in 2023, 15th century, or it could be right at the start when I first got into creating gardens, infatuated with the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and how it was a gift from Hammurabi to his wife. And I was like, well, that's amazing, isn't it? But that idea that, like, you couldn't actually put a year on the garden, it looks like it's always been there, and it just gets better. It just gets better and better and better, because nature doesn't really, nature's timeless. It doesn't have a stamp on it, you know? And in there, I mean, quite often people say, like, the Garden of Eden. I've never really read about it, but I think the thing is, gardens are strange places, because you turn to them in the kind of, there's never a time when you can't make, never a time when you don't need to be in the presence of a garden. And so whether it's a high or a low period in your life, or whether it's just a daily, have a cup of coffee in the morning, you know, it's nature's way of kind of like inspiring and amazing you. And I guess it would just be a garden that was like full of activity. Like, it doesn't matter when, even if you go into it like 4 o'clock in the morning with a head torch or something, you'd still be inspired, and you still come across I like to, one thing that I like to do when the weather's nice is grab a blanket and have a picnic, but don't go to the areas that I've created deliberately for sitting down and having a meal. So I'll literally find the corner that I'll always walk by, and I'll sit down there. And the second you drop down to like child's level, everything, the world becomes far more interesting. And also, you see the garden from an angle that you've never seen before. And I'm pretty sure you could do this with any size garden, but it's just remarkable how it completely changes your appreciation of the garden. And even when I'm designing gardens, actually, I like to design them from like the four corners. So I'll design them as though I'm looking at them from the north and then from the south and then the east and the west. And it's the same mind, it's the same ideas, it's the same client briefing and everything. But I've come up with four different gardens. And then when I put them all together, I'm like, oh, that's quite interesting, isn't it? If I did it the other, like from that aspect. And so, yes, I think my ideal garden would be something that was like that, obviously the functional level, the edible side of it, biodiversity, all those kind of things. With like copper beaches, because I love copper beaches, they're magnificent. But certainly with that time and still, you couldn't say whether it was man-made or whether it was just nature, and you couldn't say if it was man-made when it was created, you know, it's just, yeah.
It's very beautiful. It sounds, I suppose, like the garden takes on its own character as we need it to take on a different character, different times, different moods, different seasons. And as you've very clearly described, different locations, we get a different point of view. And that's the sort of so beautiful thing about this. It's almost like a living work of art that's constantly changing, and it exists because of all of those interconnected elements. Have you got some favourites? You've said the copper beaches, which is a sort of beautiful I suppose it's giving so much life in all the different seasons. And have you got any other favourites that you really like to include in there?
Oh, that is a good question. There's so many. I'm more of a tree person, I have to say. But I think one of the images that hits me hardest, or like hardest in a good sense, is that image of not necessarily an ancient woodland, but the, you know, when you get the bluebells and the snowdrops and everything, and they get that kind of like I don't know what the word is in English, tamise. You get that like broken light coming through the canopy. That's the images that I think are, and funnily enough, it's probably one of the most rarest habitats now in nature is ancient woodlands. They all have their kind of, like, so if I'm starting a bit of a woodland kind of scene, I'm working on projects at the moment, and we're trying to incorporate, like, on Earth, like a stairist ziggurat-style garden. I don't know why it's like that, but it is like that. They obviously did some land works before, and we're creating, so I've got my list of all the species that aren't there that I think probably should be there. And we're going to create, and so I like to get in a lot of silver birch. I always think that they're magical, you know. They kind of look snowy even if it's in the middle of summer because of all the white bark. And they start off when they're young. They're quite copper as well, quite bronze. So those are beautiful. And it's just a simple silver birch. You know? Quite interesting in a sense because you can coppice them and you can light fires with the bark and everything. And also a really good indicator of air quality as well. I think it's one of the fastest trees to encourage lichen to start growing on the bark as well. So it's a really good indicator of air quality. To get those now, and also the wood itself breaks down really quickly, so that's good. You know, you can build up a lot of structure very quickly, and like I say, you can coppice it. So we're going to do a series of like open grown standard, as I call them, trees, and then a lot of coppiced areas. So yeah, and also I don't think what it's called in English. In French, it's called charm, which is quite nice. Hornbeam as well. Hornbeam has a fantastic structure. If you ever have the chance to find, because I don't know if there's that many of them, hornbeam trees are just so gnarly and twisted. They're just like, as much as a beech tree has an exceptional elephant's foot kind of pounding into the ground, big trunk with really long lateral branches that are almost vertical. The hornbeams are so gnarly and twisted And they're just fascinating. Like whenever I walk past a really old hornbeam, I'm just trying to make sense of the branches and like why it would grow in the way it does. You know, most trees have a sort of like the magic number within them. You can kind of see how the structure evolved if they haven't been chopped into pieces. You can see how they, if you stand underneath an oak tree, you can see how the branches have kind of twisted around and taken up space. And you can read into its history. But a hornbeam just doesn't make any sense at all. Like that's so, they're great. Yeah, they're really good. Yeah.
There's this character coming through for these gardens that it really does feel like we're there in nature, as you described, timeless. It has been there forever. You're talking about a space that is certainly not your typical allotment and certainly not your typical lawn. You're merging the edible factor in, but in a very organic way. Do you always consider these spaces to be producing food alongside just being wonderful spaces to be in?
Yeah, well, they will, like regardless of how I plan them, they will produce food for some things and well. So there's that to take into consideration, bear in mind. But in terms of like whether there's an edible for us element within them, I guess it's more the client and the brief of the project that would decide that. So I can't really impose that. If I had it my way, I'd probably encourage the clients to give more to nature and less to the actual food growing side of it. But it's really down, it's like food growing on a home, on like for you and your family, it has to be a lifestyle choice. I don't think economically it necessarily works out incredibly well. Unless you enjoy it as a hobby, unless it's really a part of your lifestyle. And by that, I mean all aspects of it, because growing food is like the first chapter. It's not even the first chapter. It's like the third chapter, because you have to have a garden and some space and maintain it and have good soil, et cetera, find seeds. But then even when you do have produce, as you find out very quickly when you're moving to the countryside and creating a permaculture garden, is you have a glut of something and you don't know what to do with it. So you need to suddenly be a magician in the kitchen and be equipped as well. Like these big country kitchens, there's a reason why they're big. And then you don't have, like no house nowadays is born with a root cellar. That doesn't exist. I always say to my clients, if you want something exceptional, have a bothy and have a root cellar. And then you're like, you're right up there in terms of growth. So like the storage as well, we've got it at the moment. So literally this morning, we harvested our last bed of potatoes for the winter. And these are the ones to be stored for as long as possible to get us through the winter. But you have to have somewhere to store them, you know. And why do you suddenly want to store like 100 kilos of potatoes? It's not easy. The conditions are quite unique. And modern houses, and even my old house, doesn't actually have an area where we're geared up for storage. So like after the growing, there's a lot to consider, and there's a lot of different things to master as well if you really want to get good at it, and not become self-sufficient, but like have a garden that functions. But you know, it starts in the garden, moves to the kitchen, goes to the cellar, comes out of the cellar, goes into the it's a lot of it's pretty labor intensive. Yeah, but I prefer giving more to nature and less to us. I don't think we need as much as we think we need. So, for example, my garden is, I'd say the vegetable garden is maybe 200 square meters. It's about a third of it is orchard, fruits, nuts, walnuts, cob nuts, chestnuts, and then a proper no dig. Maybe 10 by 15 meter vegetable garden. A bit fancy, because I like to make things a bit fancy with like new tree hedging and things like that. But there's not actually that much, you know. I don't know what the rules are. I can't remember if someone said like you can make an activity out of 1,000 square meters if it's managed well. So one person, 1,000 square meters, no dig. I'm not too sure how big Homemakers is with Charles Irving, but he's got people helping him as well from time to time. So you can be really productive with not a lot. And that's important, actually, because the one thing that nature is very good at doing, nature doesn't really have a morale as such. Nature doesn't have a kind of, I'm having a good day or I'm having a bad day. Nature is relentless in every sense of the word. And we're not. And so when nature wins, which it does quite often, it can beat you into, it can beat you into submission. And having dreams, having expectations and dreams beyond your physical capabilities is something that I'm confronted by quite a lot in our garden and with my clients as well. So they will say to me, I want 15,000 square meters of edible garden. And straight away, I'm just like, no, you don't. Because that's a lot of maintaining. And also that's an enormous amount of food. Why would you, like, how big is your family? So I try and bring everything into realistic, manageable proportions, just so that way you don't feel like you're being consumed by a wall of green that takes over all your hard work. It's far better to start small and progress year on year whilst you master a new hobby skill as well.
Yeah, wonderful. It sounds like the whole kind of full production, feed the family from the land, it's a lifestyle choice that's quite intense. And like you said, requires all of those different aspects to go alongside it. If you were to put forward a plan to somebody that wanted to find a quite a balance between a beautiful garden and then some low maintenance food production, how would you advise them to start that out?
It's very difficult at the start. So I like to give my clients like a questionnaire that they can just leave on their coffee table or whatever and add bits to. And like, so that way the family talks about it, you know, as a bit of a field conductor, as a kind of like a guide. And I'll leave that with them for, well, I don't know, a couple of weeks, a month, however long it takes before the project starts, really. But and what they put down on there is just like, I don't know, there's five of us in the family and we're going to spend 3 days every week, all five of us. And again, it's like, yeah, in a perfect world. But when it's raining and the kids don't want to go outside and there's this to be done. And a lot of gardening isn't just the pulling of the carrot. You know, a lot of gardening is hard work. And like I said, there's that relentless aspect to it. How would the best way to do it is to start with what you like. Yeah. Start small. Start with everything that's tasty or you find tasty. So if you like growing Jerusalem artichoke, plant loads of Jerusalem artichoke. That's a good example because they will just come. You can just leave them and they do their thing. You dig them up when you want them and they're great. So definitely work with everything that you like and taste of. Because if you grow something that you don't like, yeah, your motivation's gone straight away. In fact, that was Hugh Richards. I don't know if you know Hugh Richards. I think he's a permaculture gardener in Wales. He's got a YouTube channel, and he said that he's like, best advice has got to be grow what you love. You know, you're eating it, and everyone can do that as well. So the kids like my boys. They absolutely love raspberries. I never get to eat any strawberries or raspberries, even though I've got loads in my garden. Because every morning they just go out and they're like the birds. They just bam, 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 bam. So I haven't ate strawberries for ages. I even have to go and buy strawberries from the local farm because my kids eat all my strawberries and my raspberries. So that's a good example. Grow loads of strawberries, grow loads of raspberries. In terms of the structure of the garden and like how you live day to day, if you can't, you know, ultimately inputs and outputs, the more time you spend in your garden, the better it will be and the more produce you have. That's pretty logical, I'd say. There's a fantastic Chinese proverb. I don't have many, but this one was particularly good. And it was the best soil amendment is the shade of the gardener, implying that your presence is enough. That's all you need to do, just be present. It's a bit like yoga. As long as you turn up and do it, you're there. That's the hardest bit. And then afterwards, yeah, so if you know that you don't have a lot of time, you're busy, as everyone is, then get in everything that's kind of effortless. Get all your rhubarb crowns and things like that. Just fill the garden up with things that you can just literally forget about. And then when you do stumble across them in the undergrowth one day. You're like, oh yeah, we planted a rhubarb crown that came from so-and-so's garden, and 10 years later it's absolutely massive and you've got enough to do all sorts of amazing jams with. And just like, if anyone gives you a plant, don't leave it on the side and like do some sort of like cognitive exercise about where nature thinks is the best place to plant it. Just get it in the ground, and then next year you'll probably have like enough to divide it up 5 different ways, and then you've got loads of raspberries absolutely everywhere. So I've got like an area in the garden right at the back on the left, and it's for butterflies, it's chestnuts, and it's all the different types of coppice trees. And one year I had loads of raspberries, and I was like, what do you do with raspberries? So I was like, well, I'll just stick them in the coppice area and just see what they do. So there are raspberry plants absolutely everywhere in the coppice area. They don't give me any fruit, but if ever I need to plant them at a client's garden, they're in really soft soil because of all the leaf litter, and I know that they just take off like crazy. So I've got an infinite supply of raspberries now. And then I've got another area, which my kids eat. So it's getting all of those, and Jerusalem artichokes is good. There are so many perpetual leeks, perpetual onions, Japanese ones. You can go to town on it. It doesn't have to be annual. The annuals is what takes the time. Yeah. And then all of your nuts. Nuts are just amazing. Like I don't know whether it's true or not, but it seems to be the case that when you look around Brittany where I live, quite often the first tree directly in the middle behind the house is a walnut tree. Now, I don't know whether that's some sort of superstition or whether it's just because walnuts give you a lot of free food once they're up and running. So we have one, the next door neighbor has one. I've seen it all over the place. All of the nut trees are fantastic. Hazelnuts is good as well. That really is free food. Our garden was designed as a food forest. But I don't, because they take so long to get going, not many clients ask me to do food forest. I kind of embrace that in my designs anyway, without them really knowing. But food like that for free is pretty fantastic. And also it stores really well. So we've always got like hidden up in the rafters above the fire in the kitchen. There are those like white Paris mushroom, like blue Paris mushroom kind of like cases, you know. And they're just full of walnuts. And they're up there and they're really dry. And if ever anyone wants them, you give them to them. And that's from the old walnut that was here when we bought the house. But we planted other grafted walnuts. So we're going to be drowning in walnuts at some point. So that's a good thing to do.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. Like this sense of letting nature thrive. And then you kind of get in this bounty that keeps increasing all the time from these perennial crops, essentially, the trees and the fruit. And then some vegetables that are perennial also can be mixed in there, which is wonderful. I thought it'd be good if we had a little look at your own property. That you've talked a lot about what you have output there for the family, and the strawberries for the children to browse on, and the walnuts. But I think an acre and a half, which it's a big garden, but really too small to maybe think of as a farm. It's there sort of in between. And yet you have used that as a productive business. You mentioned at the beginning the cut flowers and the edible flowers that come off that. I wondered if you had any insights from working on that scale of property to consider it a productive business.
Yeah, we when we set off on this journey, we wanted to create a garden that was always a family garden. But we also knew that we wanted to make a living off of it as well. And that's happened like in many different ways. So at the moment, the garden isn't, we kind of went through four generations, family garden, edible flowers, which slowly took over the garden with straight beds and everything. And then cut flowers, and now biodiversity gardens, so wildflowers essentially. I think in terms of like really commercial activity, the most we've ever had would be maybe 500-600 square meters, something like that. just edible flowers, which isn't a lot. But I mean, you're dealing with something which is like really, like you'd be hard pressed to harvest anything smaller than an edible flower. Like sometimes it's ridiculous. Like if ever you've tried harvesting, and not many people have, I don't think, like the difference between harvesting a cosmos flower, you know, they're pretty big, or dahlia even, or tulip, I think they're both edible as well. They're big, so that doesn't take very long at all. But once we had a chef order like 1,000 rocket flowers, and it took me a lifetime. It took me like 4 hours to harvest 1,000 rocket flowers because they all have to be perfect and they can't be too wet. And you've got to do it. Not just open, so that way they open during the storage at the restaurant for the ready to use. If they're open when you harvest them, it's already too late. They'll just fan them. Not good to use. And then beyond that, there's the rosemary flowers. Like rosemary flowers are tiny. You need a pair of tweezers to get them off. They're edible, but like you may as well just shake the bush and just hope that there's some good ones in there because they're just impossible. So we're dealing with something that is like not microscopic, but very, very small. Because it was a niche, and so we could do that. If you're doing vegetables, like I said before, I'm pretty sure that they work on like 1,000 square meters minimum. Afterwards, it all depends on how much you want to earn and what your overheads are and things like that. But like I said, the no-dig, no-till gardeners, they're fantastic because they just want to do good. And the amount of information you can get from them alone without spending any money either in the community that surrounds them, there are some pretty amazing stories of what people achieve. They get to levels of efficiency that are just mind-boggling, and it's not dependent upon technology either. So I've got some pretty cool equipment, but it's still hand tools. There's no, like, these guys, they don't, the idea was, I think, right at the start in the permaculture movement, is like, how can you do farming without the need for petrochemicals? For diesel and petrol and those kind of things. And so none of them, I don't think, have got like tractors. They might have walk behind machine rotavators and things like that, or just to till the first couple of centimeters, or for the initial creation of the bed. So they're working like on low tech, low area as well, but really, really high efficiency and high yield and soil quality and soil health. So, I mean, if anyone was thinking about starting doing that, I mean, I'm not from an agricultural background, so I couldn't really go into much detail. I suppose the third of what I do, which is beauty, would be replaced by edible, because you still have the biodiversity in agriculture. It's needed, but they would get rid of the beautiful bit, and then they have like 2/3 edible, 1/3 biodiversity. I don't know how they work. But you don't need a lot. And I think technical acumen would win the day in that sense. In our case, the edible flowers was really quite a niche because of where we're situated. The fact that we're in France, so there's a lot of gastronomic restaurants. But conversely, the culture in France is not to eat edible flowers. And edible flowers started in the UK 10, 15 years before it started in France. You know, we jumped on the boat because of well, my wife did that as part of her practical sustainability course. And then she found out that there was Greens of Devon. I think there's a couple in the southwest. There's two women in the southwest of the UK that grow edible flowers. Now they're everywhere. And we started a bit the trend in Brittany. And I think since we started, there's probably another 10 growers, like one every year, that's set up. Even in our tiny garden, like we used to have 5, 6, 7 trainees come and spend like 2 weeks with us at a time. So there was a real, because you are mixing edible with beauty, the flowers. So that attracts quite a lot of people, mostly women. Guys tend to be more machines. Because we even thought about doing vegetables at one point, but we knew that vegetables was, A, there's a lot of people doing it, B, you're not working on quantity, you're working on, you're not working on quality, you're working on quantity, which means that you need to have more space and you need to have a bigger production to get those margins. So we chose to do edible flowers, and we just, you don't always have to have a clear idea, I don't think, when you're starting out on a project. So I when people ask me for advice because they're starting a new garden or on permaculture or teaching or doing training or things like around edible gardens, I always say to them, well, just, you know, there's a lot of people doing it now. This is 2023. It's been around a long time, since the 70s or something, certain permaculture. You know, just make sure that whatever you do, you're really good at it and everyone knows how good you are. And then you just get renowned, don't you? So, you know, you kind of, your head sticks out from the group, and yeah.
So you're sort of really found a niche with the flowers, and that sounds like a really fantastic approach, is to, like you say, just find something and be very, very good at it so that you stand out. Another thing that you've done, which I think is also a very clever niche, is work directly with restaurants and with the chefs to create a growing space behind the restaurants. And I wondered if, I mean, it's a fantastic way to shorten the supply chain, like to literally grow it right there so the chef can pick the food. It must be a very high quality result for the customers that experience that. Do you have any insights of what you've learned from working in that manner?
What we quickly realized is that if we supply restaurants with things that they can grow themselves, it won't take long for them to cotton on that they should probably just start growing them themselves. Obviously, there's some things that they can't do because they're quite technical to grow and to harvest at the right time and the conditions and everything. So one of my jobs was to create environments in the garden to bring in new plants. So my wife would say, I've got this, where do we put it? Well, we don't have anywhere for wild garlic. Let's create an area for wild garlic. What conditions are they like? And so I would literally go around the garden looking for those conditions or trying to create them. You can create them sometimes quickly. You might already have them. Sometimes they take a long time. With the chefs, it was it's difficult because they're very, you know, chefs are very, they're very much in the public eye. Their image is really important. You invite people to your garden when you want to, but with a restaurant, your clients come to you. So straight away you've got visibility on the garden. So that it needs to look good. And that's difficult to manage because you're there to grow stuff. You're not there to make the garden look pretty all the time. You know, if you want to leave a bit of sheeting around because you need to knock out a bed to flip it over and get it producing again, well, you do what you have to do. But second, you've got clients like literally eating behind the window and they're looking at you. It's a bit strange. And then there's also we work with scales now that are just immense. So in France, like, there's a lot of local markets, there's a lot of produce, there's a lot of food. And so to get your hands on vegetables and fruits and things is pretty straightforward. You know, you don't really need to leave. So, and I said this to the chefs right at the start as well, we can produce gardens, but it needs to be an ethical, philosophical, like, shift in terms of your mindset, in terms of you, your style of cooking, and your team that works with you. We need to create a link between the garden and your team, because otherwise, so what happens is we go there maybe once every 2 weeks, 3 weeks, obviously less of a winter, more in the growing season. We start the seed trays here, we take them over there, and we plant them, we flip beds and do all that kind of stuff. We want it like a market garden, like the no-dig guys. A bit like, I think it's called Curtis Stone. He's got a lot of urban gardens that he uses for production. People give him their gardens or they have some sort of contract. So he's got loads of little plots for him. So it's a bit like that. But it's very difficult because if you work solely on the economical side of it, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because, you know, you can buy produce from a farm which is 30 hectares and they've produce so much that they've drilled the unit price down, 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 and it's their job. You know, it's fundamental. They are there to grow food 100% of the time. So to create food in your back garden, you won't get it cheaper. Once you put in my hourly rate, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes, you know, you plant things and things just go wrong. Like 30 million pigeons decide to eat all of your seeds the day after you've sown them. But, and so the best ones are the chefs that say, oh, you know what, I'm going to do this, not because financially on my bottom line it makes sense, but in the world that I am trying to promote and how I want to cook, I want there to be zero distance between me and the source of my produce. And that is more important than the cost. And also, I want to have the best understanding of where it comes from. I want to know everything about my produce. And you can visit sites now and visit farms now, and they have really good relationships with the chefs and everything. But, you know, if you've got it yourself, it is 100% trust there. The projects that we did have, we never quite managed to get the point where we take someone from the kitchen, someone in the team, and we get them to work in the garden with us. Because that's really, I think that's when a bit like in every job, you know, it's when you get that mix of skills and the overlap. That's where you get the innovation. That's when it becomes interesting. And we never quite managed to do that because COVID hit and things got a little bit difficult. But it is fascinating. What's good about them is that they tend to be in town. So you don't get just badgers destroying everything, and you don't get like big storms just whipping through your polytunnels. They tend to be quite walled off as well, so you get a lot of protective little niches to grow your produce. But you don't have the organic matter because you haven't got that one third biodiversity, hedgerows, etc. So they're very difficult to manage. You have to. We needed to bring in a lot of materials to get them going. So, for example, the restaurant bought chickens from an organic farmer, and he bought in like the biggest trailer load of chicken manure I've ever seen. But it was a mix. So some of it was fantastic. You could grow straight into it. And others, it was like from last week. So we're like, okay, well, that needs to break down for at least a year. That we can put out. But we can't just put that on because it's going to be really rich. So like, what can we plant into that? That's a bit difficult. We didn't have any like woody, leafy matter or like, no brown material. So yeah, you get some really weird scenarios when you don't have a complete picture of nature to work with, a complete like gamut of everything that nature can provide. It becomes very difficult, sourcing everything. It just really has to be as much as it is a lifestyle choice when it's your garden, it needs to be very much the same for a chef and his team as well. So they've really got to like fall passionately in love with their garden. Otherwise, it's not going to work. It just won't work.
There's been such a fantastic range of ideas and experiences that you've shared, and I've really enjoyed going through all of this and learning all these insights from you. Thank you so much for being here. Have you got any particular focuses that you're working on at the minute that you'd like to share with people and maybe share how they can also learn more from you?
Yeah, the current, I'm just trying to just raise awareness and get people talking about it, but in the correct context. So maybe talk a little bit less about energy and carbon dioxide, as much as this is called We Are Carbon, you know? I see a lot of money put into like, how can we reduce our carbon emissions? And yet I get like 0.01% of the budget towards biodiversity. And I'm like, you know what? If you work on soil health, you probably work on carbon capture as well. Go feel better that way, maybe. But it's quite a difficult conversation to have because it's not just abstract numbers. You can't just say like 20 tons or 20 pounds equals one. You know, biodiversity doesn't really work like that. So I'm just trying to raise awareness. Like I contacted this morning, the local golf course, just went onto their website. They didn't have anything about corporate social responsibility, nothing about biodiversity, and their golf site with like a golf course with I don't know how many hectares of land. So I was like, that's a bit weird. With farmers as well. There's a lot of organic farmers that want to do good, but it's not necessarily their it's not their job to manage biodiversity. So they do their best, and they go so far, but ultimately they're there to produce whatever that may be. So I like to think that we can walk hand in hand to a better future in that respect. Just try and have as much an impact as possible in a good sense, and leave a legacy. I think if everyone works with that in mind, you're like, what legacy am I going to leave here for the next generation? That's important. That's important. Yeah. And if anyone wants to learn more about it, I mean, like, I often refer to my godmother and godfather of biodiversity and no dig and all these kind of things. Just drop me an email and I'll send you a long list of people. Like we haven't mentioned the Soil Food Web in the US, Dr. Elaine Ingham and Charles Dowding. So Charles Dowding's actually doing it in no dig and growing stuff, and Dr. Elaine Ingham is basically one of the, like, she's my godmother of soil microbiology, and she is the one that advises all the farms and everything on how best to make compost, robust compost that survives, and it has a complete plethora of everything that you need. And like I said, it's a beautiful time to be alive, because we live in an age when knowledge is just, it's absolutely everywhere. Like, just 5 minutes when you wake up in the morning, you have a coffee and you just turn on your mobile phone or your computer or something, just bombarded by a wealth of just exceptional people giving time and, well, like you here, you know, now us, and it's free, so embrace it. Yeah,
fantastic, absolutely true, and very well said. Thank you. And thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Carbon. You can find links in the description to explore more from Daniel and some of the other sources that he mentioned. And alongside, there's info to help you learn more with We Are Carbon. There are many conversations that we've had now, and even a new format with animations to help us digest some of the big concepts. I'll highlight a few bits so you can get a feel for all the formats. Don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date. And let's keep figuring this all out together.